This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, June 8th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. I do not have a guest today. Instead, I'm going to share with you an article that I wrote a couple of years ago entitled, "We Are Not Going to War Over a Bunch of Dead Sailors." The subtitle is, "The USS Liberty, a Flubbed Up False Flag." By 1948, under David Ben-Gurion's direction, the newly established Israeli government developed Unit 131, an Israeli terrorist cell. In the mid-1950s, the United States was friends with Gamal Abdel Nasser, the second president of Egypt. He served from 1956 until his death in 1970. Ben-Gurion, an avid Zionist and Israel's first prime minister, visualized an Egyptian terrorist attack against the United States, which would destroy that alliance. However, that was not a probability, given the relationship between the two countries. The Israelis, many of whom had a lengthy history using terrorism and false flag events, then developed a pattern of using young Israelis who disguised themselves as citizens of whichever country they were attempting to implicate to engage in terrorist activities in that country or in other countries. They applied this concept during Operation Cyanide, involving the USS Liberty, in an attempt to initiate warfare. Now, before I discuss the USS Liberty event, keep in mind that, under the same president, Lyndon B. Johnson, the Gulf of Tonkin incident allegedly occurred on August the 2nd and the 4th in 1964, just 3 years before the USS Liberty event. Shortly before midnight on August 4th, Johnson delivered a radio speech in which he described an attack by North Vietnamese vessels on two U.S. Navy ships, the USS Maddox and the USS Turner Joy, and he requested the authority to undertake a military response. His speech repeatedly accused Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh as the aggressor, which put the United States into a more acceptable defensive posture. Johnson repeatedly referred to the attacks as having taken place on the high seas, suggesting that they had occurred in international waters, which was very significant because that would imply that the United States had a responsibility to respond militarily, if in fact there was an attack. All right, now getting on to the USS Liberty. Certain very influential individuals in the political apparatus of the United States had Israeli sympathies and were quite willing to accommodate the Israeli agenda, even if it hurt American citizens in the process. Consequently, U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara, per President Johnson's instructions, advanced Admiral John S. McCain, Jr., the father of Senator John McCain, to a four-star commanding position in February of 1967. Army General Lyman L. Lemnitzer, of North Woods fame, then positioned Admiral McCain as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Navy in Europe. Admiral McCain would direct his operations from an office in London. Okay, so that was in February. So on May 23, 1967, Deputy Secretary of Defense Cyrus R. Vance instructed through his subordinates William L. McGonigal, the captain of the USS Liberty, to head for the Eastern Mediterranean Sea by way of Rota, Spain. Thereafter, Admiral McCain, the commander-in-chief over Europe, would assume responsibility for the special operations of that ship and its crew, which would be involved as soon as the ship arrived at Rota. Frank Raven, a G Group chief, resisted such a risky move. He said, and I quote, "The ship will be defenseless out there. If war breaks out, she'll be alone and vulnerable. Either side might start shooting at her. I say the ship should be left where it is," unquote. Previously, Johnson promised Israel continued support and assistance in reopening the Straits of Tyran, previously closed to Israel by Egypt. Israel was already developing a nuclear program in the Negev Desert, but also wanted additional military assistance from the United States, including 100 Hawk missiles, 140 Patton tanks, and 24 Skyhawk jets. John P. Roche, an avid supporter of Israel, wrote Johnson's speech regarding the Straits of Tehran, which he delivered in May 1967. Johnson had many Jewish advisors and friends, including the very attractive Matilda Krim. Matilda Krim's first husband was David Dannon, a Bulgarian Jew and a member of Ergun, a terrorist group. She converted to Judaism and associated with many of Israel's future leaders, as she had been a dedicated gun-running member of Ergun, headed by Menachem Begin, prior to 1948. She was also friendly with the Stern Gang, another Zionist terrorist group founded by Avraham Stern and headed by Yitzhak Shamir. In 1958, she married Arthur B. Krim, a New York attorney and head of United Artists, and a close advisor to Johnson and an avid Zionist. Krim was the finance chairman for the Democratic National Committee and ran the President's Club, Johnson's fundraising apparatus that held a $1,000 a plate dinner in New York on June 3, 1967. Arthur Krim built a huge vacation mansion right next door to Johnson's Texas ranch. On June 3, 1967, same date as that big dinner, in New York, the USS Liberty was trolling in international waters, as we've mentioned before, off the coast of the Gaza Strip, where the ship was to engage in an extended independent surveillance operation in the eastern Mediterranean. Israel launched a long-planned war against her Arab neighbors at 7:45 a.m. Sinai time on June 5, 1967. In 1982, Menachem Begin, then Israel's prime minister, admitted, and I quote, "The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him," unquote. Mordecai Bentov, a member of Israel's coalition cabinet during the war, said, and I quote, "All this story about the danger of extermination has been a complete invention and has been blown up a posteriori to justify the annexation of new Arab territories," unquote. President Johnson, an apparently energetic philanderer, given the number and notoriety of his sexual exploits, was in Texas until June 1st when he returned with his friend, Matilda Krim, who remained at the White House with Johnson for the next week. Johnson was absolutely dazzled by Matilda's blonde beauty and intelligence. When his aides informed him of the beginning of the war on the morning of June 5th, Johnson revealed this information to Matilda Krim, the first person he told. Official records indicate that Matilda passed documents from Israel directly to Johnson over the duration of the crises. Johnson did not meet with his advisors, except Walt Rostow, or any Israeli or Arab officials during the duration of the very short war. He knew exactly what was going on with the Israelis due to his very intimate relationship with Matilda Krim. Obviously, she worked for the Israeli government. It was evident, as that first day progressed, that Egypt was unprepared and inundated by Israel's aggressiveness. Ambassador Michael Haddow, A British expert on Israel and the Middle East did not believe that war was inevitable. Yet, U.S. government officials ignored his advice regarding any negotiation possibilities. He sent a telegram to the British Foreign Office saying, and I quote, "It looks as if the Israelis started it. We have been led up the garden path," unquote. Abba Eban, Israel's foreign minister, told U.S. Ambassador Walworth Barber that his government was going to protest Egypt's actions to the U.N. Security Council. Eban, along with other dignitaries, misled the entire world but never offered any apologies for his deception about Egypt initiating the war. The Western media characterized Israel as a vulnerable country threatened with extinction by its Arab neighbors. Rather than a war of land seizure, Israeli officials portrayed the conflict as a defensive war of survival. However, Israel kept all the land her military grabbed. Of course, it was all over the news, and millions of Americans believed that the Arabs had started the war and attacked the poor, defenseless state of Israel, an act that could have erupted into World War III. Although both parties, the Arabs and the Jews, had participated in the warfare, the Israelis were the only people who had immediate access to President Johnson anytime they wanted. Conversely, the Arabs were silenced by their inaccessibility to the White House and the U.S. media. Yitzhak Rabin, former chief of staff and then ambassador to the United States, said, and I quote, "I do not believe that Nasser wanted war. The two divisions he sent into Sinai on May 14th would not have been enough to unleash an offensive against Israel. He knew it and we knew it," unquote. Rabin recognized that any country with good intelligence, like Israel, could ascertain that Egypt had no plans to wage war against Israel. The CIA, before the war, embraced Israel's views about Egypt's intentions. Israel would have won any war, a veritable turkey shoot, in a week. Further, Israeli intelligence had broken the Arab codes as soon as the fighting started. The Israelis also had the ability to block and alter all communications between King Hussein and Cairo and Egypt's military. Israel, with military and tactical superiority, altered the communications to give the Arabs the impression that they were winning, when in fact the Israeli soldiers were ambushing and summarily slaughtering them. Israel had air supremacy immediately after their surprise attack on Egypt. Within hours, Israeli jets pummeled 25 air bases from Damascus in Syria to Luxor. They used machine guns, mortar fire, tanks, and air power in their assault against the Jordanian section of Jerusalem and the Jordan River's West Bank. Israeli tanks and auxiliary personnel personnel transporters assaulted the Sinai moving towards the Suez Canal. They transformed the area into a massive killing field, as Egyptian deaths, according to one Israeli general, amounted to between 7,000 to 10,000 people. His losses, the Israeli losses, were only about 275 soldiers. Israeli soldiers attacked Indian peacekeeper soldiers, flying the UN flag on their way to Gaza. The soldiers killed 14 peacekeeper soldiers in what one Indian officer called the deliberate, cold-blooded killing of unarmed UN soldiers. The Israelis had captured some Egyptians and held them in the town of El Arish. By June 8th, the prisoners had become annoyances, as the Israelis had no place to house them and insufficient forces to guard them and too few vehicles to move them to regular prison camps. Consequently, the Israelis transformed the town into a slaughterhouse by methodically butchering their Egyptian prisoners. They lined up 60 unarmed Egyptians with their hands tied behind their backs and with machine guns slaughtered them in cold blood. They machine gunned another group of 30 prisoners nearby. The Israelis directed some Bedouins to bury those victims. In yet another incident, the number of Egyptian prisoners killed totaled about 150, as witnessed by an Israeli journalist, Gabby Braun. The Israelis forced some prisoners to dig graves for the dead, and then the Israelis shot them. Eriyahu Yazaki, an Israeli army historian, and other officers collected testimony from dozens of soldiers who admitted killing Egyptian prisoners. According to Yazaki, Israeli soldiers murdered about 1,000 Egyptian prisoners in the Sinai, including about 400 in El Arish. Ariel Sharon was close to El Arish at the time of the incident. Yazaki said that the Israeli leadership, Dayan, Rabin, and others knew and probably ordered the slaughter. The USS Liberty, close to El Arish at the time, and loaded with a 10 million point two dollars worth of sensitive equipment, eavesdropped on Israel's six-day war with Egypt, then known as the United Arab Republic. The Israelis were aware, by 10:55 the morning of June 8th, that a clearly marked U.S. ship was off the coast and unmistakably visible from El Arish. On that day, June 8, 1967, without any warning and apparently without reason, the Israeli Navy and Air Force attacked the ship with torpedoes, rockets, white phosphorus, cannons, and armor-piercing bullets. The Israelis used napalm, a flammable liquid or jellied gasoline, to turn the Liberty's deck into a 3,000-degree holocaustic firestorm. 34 Americans were killed and 171 others were wounded, one of which died later from his wounds. Developers designed napalm to kill and maim, generate panic, and cause confusion. The first wave of attacks, comprised of as many as 8 planes using heat-seeking missiles, destroyed the transformers, miraculously all except one, which fed the aerial systems. This was a well-planned, premeditated strategy to prevent the USS Liberty from alerting the world of this murderous attack. The surveillance ship was no longer able to listen into the war or send messages. If that was the objective of the attack, then they met the goal and the attack should have subsided. However, the real objective was to slaughter the crew and send the ship to the bottom of the ocean. Finally, the planes left, and then 3 surface craft appeared and began firing torpedoes. One hit below the waterline and made a hole which measured 45 feet by 34 by 37. Amazingly, the ship did not sink, but listed 11 degrees. When the crew inflated the lifeboats, the Israeli torpedo boats even destroyed those lifeboats. The war was over by June 8th, and Egypt had lost. The men on the USS Liberty first assumed that the Arabs in unmarked planes and ships were attacking their ship in retaliation for U.S. support of Israel. There were 294 survivors from the premeditated Israeli attack directed by Moshe Dayan. Survivors were unable to find the remains of 5 men but only found body parts which they placed into sacks for burial. Vice Admiral William I. Martin, a former World War II test pilot and Pentagon loyalist, had assumed command of the 6th Fleet in April 1967. Notice how they put all of these people in position for this operation a few months before it actually occurred. So the plans for this operation were probably started back in, well, who knows, at least by January. During Israel's assault, there were several U.S. ships in the area. The aircraft carrier Saratoga, commanded by Captain Joseph Tully, the flagship commanded by Vice Admiral Martin, a cruiser commanded by Rear Admiral Roger Payne. The USS America, a new aircraft carrier, was under the command of Captain Don Engen. Rear Admiral Lawrence Guise was the 6th Fleet Carrier Division commander. Additionally, there were approximately a dozen escorting destroyer ships. The Saratoga's communications officer received a message from the Liberty addressed to any or all U.S. ships or stations. It said, and I quote, "Liberty is under attack by unknown enemy air and surface units. Request assistance," unquote. Help was about 15 or 20 minutes away from the Liberty. Captain Tully notified Vice Admiral Martin and said, and I quote, "Unless otherwise directed, I plan to launch my ready strike group in support of Liberty," unquote. Martin approved and directed the USS America to launch their ready strike group. However, Rear Admiral Geis, that's G-E-I-S, of the USS America recalled his aircraft, which created a dilemma for Captain Tully. Vice Admiral ordered another strike to give aid to the Liberty, but Rear Admiral Geis again recalled the planes. According to an independent unofficial study, the White House deliberately prevented the U.S. Navy from coming to the defense of the USS Liberty by recalling 6th Fleet military rescue support while the ship was under attack. McNamara, Secretary of Defense, recalled the aircraft that had been launched from the Saratoga within minutes. Certainly, he would not have made such a move without President Johnson's approval. Secretary McNamara ordered the aircraft recalled a second time. Admiral Geis was told that President Johnson had ordered the aircraft to be returned, and I quote, "He would not have his allies embarrassed. He didn't care who was killed or what was done to the ship," unquote. According to Admiral Geis, President Johnson, known for his ruthlessness and vile profanity, told Geis, and I quote, "I want that GD ship." He didn't minimize it. He said, okay, I'll just say it. "I want that goddamn ship going to the bottom. No help. Recall the wings," unquote. Tony Hart, a Navy communications technician stationed at the U.S. Navy base in Morocco in June 1967, reported that McNamara responded, and I quote, "We are not going to war over a bunch of dead sailors," unquote. If the USS Liberty had sunk, as Johnson wanted, Israel and the world, because of the media, would have blamed Egypt. Government officials, including the McCains, have maintained absolute silence regarding Israel's assault on the Liberty. And certainly, John McCain, Senator John McCain, has worked for them since that very day. The attack ended at about 3:15 p.m. A while later, Israeli helicopters circled the ship. Some of the crew members, not yet realizing that Israel was the perpetrator of the attack, were glad to see their alleged friendly ally. Then one crew member shouted, and I quote, "They've come to finish us off," unquote. The copters just hovered as the Israeli troops watched without signaling and then soared away, as if someone had finally called off the attack. The survivors were stunned by what had happened and by the total lack of response from the U.S. rescue planes. The ship generated sufficient steam to start moving from the area. There were 851 rocket hits, and the survivors estimated that at least 15 planes had targeted the USS Liberty. Survivors could have rationalized one hit as an accident, but not an attack that resulted in more than 851 holes in the vessel. They stopped counting at 851. Captain Ward Boston, the chief Navy attorney for the 1967 U.S. Navy Court of Inquiry, revealed that the clear-cut evidence demonstrated that the ship was clearly marked as an American ship. On October 9, 2003, Captain Boston said, and I quote, "Admiral Kidd and I believed with certainty that this attack was a deliberate effort to sink an American ship and murder its entire crew," unquote. Captain Boston stated that Admiral Kidd had, in 1967, concluded that the attack was, and I quote, "a case of mistaken identity," unquote, because he was, and I quote, "under direct orders to do so by Defense Secretary McNamara and President Johnson," unquote. At the time, Congress, failing in their check and balances responsibility, opted not to convene a formal investigation of the situation. The U.S. government did not hold Israel accountable, and the Israelis did not punish or reprimand anyone. The U.S. Navy prohibited its investigators from going to Israel to question Israeli pilots and boat captains. The Navy conducted an 8-day inquiry and issued a top-secret final report. Prior to the attack, Petty Officer Phil Turney had determined that there had been at least 13 overflights by Israeli planes. Two of the overflights were by planes that had the prominent Star of David plainly visible. One plane got so incredibly close that Turney waved and smiled at the pilot or co-pilot, and he smiled and waved back. The survivors knew that the attack was not the result of an identification error. On the fourth day of the war, the men on the USS Liberty, who were monitoring radio traffic during the war between Israel and Egypt, could see the smoke of the fighting, even though the ship was 13 miles from land within international waters. The military superior Israelis were decidedly victorious over Egypt. Yitzhak Rabin, the fifth prime minister of Israel, concluded that Israel was not to blame for the attack on the USS Liberty, but said, and I quote, "In any event, to express our goodwill and humanitarian concern, the Israeli government paid $6 million. That number comes up a lot with the Israelis and the Bolsheviks. They paid $6 million in compensation to the families of the Americans killed or wounded in the attack," unquote. On June 19, 1967, Abba Eban, Israel's foreign minister, delivered a speech to the Special Assembly of the United Nations in which he claimed, and I quote, "the danger to his country was great," unquote. He said, and I quote, "the military buildup in Egypt proceeded at an intensive rate. It was designed to enable Egypt to press its war plans against Israel while maintaining its violent adventures elsewhere. In the face of these developments, Israel was forced to devote an increasing part of its resources to self-defense," unquote. Eben claimed he heard the following on Cairo broadcast on May 25, 1967, and I quote, "The Arab people is firmly resolved to wipe Israel off the map and restore the honor of the Arabs of Palestine," unquote. Levi Eshkol, Israel's prime minister, in a newspaper article in October 1967, said, and I quote, "The Egyptian layout in the Sinai and the general military buildup there testified to the military defensive Egyptian setup south of Israel," unquote. Ezer Wiseman, chief of the operations staff under Rabin, told an Israeli newspaper that there was, and I quote, "no threat of destruction," unquote. He admitted that Israel's attack against Egypt, Jordan, and Syria would allow Israel to, and I quote, "exist according to the scale, spirit, and quality she now embodies," unquote. Rabin designed his deceptive claims to win the world's support and ultimately blamed the war on Nasser. Operation Cyanide was the reason that officials sent the USS Liberty into the war zone without protection. Yet 30 years after the attack, there is not a single reference to Operation Cyanide, despite numerous Freedom of Information Act requests regarding the attack. The government houses the archives for this period at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library in Austin, Texas. Among all the papers about the Liberty, there is one dated April 10, 1967. That was 3 months before the attack, stamped "Secret, Eyes Only." That document was sanitized in December 1988. It was apparently the minutes from a meeting on April 7, 1967 that included Walt Rostow, he was the National Security Advisor, Ambassador Foy Koehler, who was the Deputy Undersecretary of State, Cyrus Vance, who was the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Admiral Rufus Taylor, who was the CIA Deputy Chief. Apparently, Operation Cyanide included an Israeli war against Egypt in order to depose Gamal Abdel Nasser, a purported Soviet puppet. The U.S. government sent intelligence and military specialists to Israel months before to plan and prepare for the operation. The operation was an agreement between Israel and Johnson, during which the USS Liberty was supposed to sink along with all her crew. When Israel's attack failed to sink the ship, the game plan changed, which included an apology from Israel and a phony cover story. According to author Peter Hounem, a U.S. intelligence agent claimed that Captain McGonagall was aware of the pretext and the intentions of the U.S. to attack Egypt. Officials briefed him to anticipate a superficial strafing attack on the USS Liberty. The attack unexpectedly accelerated. Perhaps what the Liberty surveillance revealed about Israel's terrorism against the Egyptians. Certainly, Israel didn't want everybody to know that they had slaughtered all these unarmed Egyptians in cold blood. Ephraim Evron, the minister of the Israeli embassy in Washington in 1967, was an avowed socialist. He served with Ambassador Avraham Harman and viewed Johnson as an absolute hero. Johnson frequently invited Evron to his Texas ranch. In addition to Evron and Harman, Harry McPherson, special counsel in the White House, served as a link between Johnson and the country's Jewish population and represented their interest. Evron greatly admired Johnson and regarded him as the greatest thing that had ever happened to America for the social revolution that Johnson was going to achieve. He believed that Johnson, Israel's best friend, would never do anything that would hurt Israel. Johnson's affection for Jews and Israel had more to do with their votes and financial support than sentimentality or principles. The very generous U.S. Jewish community, amounting to about 5.5 million, supported Johnson's divisive Vietnam policies. In the mid-1990s, Rabin attempted to achieve peace with the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, with the U.S. acting as a mediator. Some of the other Zionists saw this as a hindrance to their plans of expanding Israel's control of the area for an ultimate greater Israel. Consequently, Yigal Amir, a young law student, whether acting on his own or as an agent, shot 5 bullets into the prime minister when he was attending a peace rally in 1995. Now, in my own opinion, any time that there is a political killing, it is planned. It is not just some lone gunman. Amir told investigators that he had absolutely no regrets. In the New York Times, dated November 27, 1995, Rabin's assassin reportedly claimed, and I quote, "According to Jewish law, the minute a Jew betrays his people and country to the enemy, he must be killed. No one taught me that law. I have been studying the Talmud all my life, and I have all the data, unquote. Senator John McCain, backed by William Kristol in the 2000 presidential race, has always supported Israel. Representative Vin Weber, a pro-Israel member of the CFR, helped found William Kristol's Empower America. Weber backed McCain in 2000 and advised McCain during his campaign. Representative Weber sabotaged an effort to force a congressional investigation of Israel's terrorist attack on the USS Liberty. Robert S. McNamara later claimed in his memoirs that he did not know what happened and did not, and I quote, take the time to find out, unquote. U.S. officials concealed the details of the attack on the USS Liberty, part of Operation Cyanide, and whitewashed all of the evidence. It took another false flag, 9/11, to get the U.S. embroiled in the Middle East. U.S. officials, urged by the families of those killed, finally convened a 9/11 commission despite Bush and Cheney's objections. However, it took time to gather the right people to staff the commission, which predictably failed to reach accurate conclusions because the government withheld essential evidence and concealed the testimony of many witnesses. One member, former U.S. Senator Bob Kerry, admitted that 9/11 was a 30-year conspiracy. Shortly after 9/11, Eckhart Wurthbach, the former president of Germany's Domestic Intelligence Service, said, and I quote, "The deathly precision and the magnitude of planning behind the attacks would have required years of planning." So he corroborated what Senator Bob Kerry said. Was 9/11 another false flag with blame again placed on the Arabs to compensate for the flubbed up false flag on June 8, 1967? Moreover, if that is the case, did the planning begin shortly after the first failure? Benjamin Netanyahu, the day after the horrific event, said that the 9/11 terror attacks were, and I quote, good for Israel. The five Israelis who were in the U.S. prior to 9/11 and were caught photographing the event admitted, and I quote, our purpose was to document the event, unquote. Thanks so much for joining me today. Bye-bye. Take care.